CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 69, with Dr. Francesco Carones, founder of Ophthalpreneurs, for the best patient experience. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, Italian surgeon Dr. Francesco Carones. Now, he's been involved in refractive surgery, the whole spectrum, corneal, lenticular, everything in between, for many years, even going back to the birth of the excimer laser, way back at the very beginning. Now he set up an amazing meeting called Ophthalmopreneurs for ophthalmologists to become entrepreneurs and really understand the business aspects of ophthalmology. He has a great meeting that has an inaugural year this year, and I'll be at his meeting next year in Sicily. So, Francesco, welcome to our podcast.
Uday, thank you so much for inviting. I'm very happy to be here. I've seen so many podcasts as a cataract coach, so happy to be part of it at this point.
Oh, thank you. No, I heard that originally you wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon.
How do you know? That's true.
How did you end up in ophthalmology? That's a very big difference.
That's a very true story. When I was doing medicine, when I was studying medicine, I did not want to do what my father was doing, not to have any sort of competition or emulation, you know, that. And so I was very interested in the aggressive surgeries like cardiothoracic or reconstructive surgery and all of that. And then I had to change my mind because since the very first autopsy that I had to attend and going on with the internship in the different surgeries, I was passed out. I was disturbed by the view of blood, and I was completely impossible to consider these surgeries as part of my job. And at that point, my father said, "Why? Come and see my surgery, and which is very elegant, no blood, microscopes, and all of that." So I joined him a couple of times in the surgery. I was feeling extremely good, and I said, "Okay, I may give a try to ophthalmology." And this is where I am now.
Oh yeah, but I had a similar experience. So, you know, my father was not an ophthalmology. But when I was in med school, I saw all the different surgeries, and there was just an elegance, a beauty, especially for me at that time, was cataract surgery. And so I was like, wow, I definitely want to do this.
Yeah. Also, because as my personal experience, I can tell you that I find myself much more in the repetitive, always the same, always planned kind of surgery rather than the, let's say, inventive, innovative, every single patient is different. So one of the advantages of cataract surgery or refractive surgery is that the more consistent you are, the more reproducible you are, the more consistent are going to be your results. And this is exactly where I like to be.
Well, me too. And so obviously the precision also is there. And we try to basically perfect the surgery, every little tiny step. Now, why in ophthalmology, why refractive surgery?
Well,
as opposed to retina or something else.
All right. So the choice was not purely mine. The choice was from my mentor at my university department. And as we were saying earlier, I was a resident in ophthalmology between 2086 and 2090. So exactly when the excimer laser was launched, and my mentor was telling me the hospital is very full, we have many doctors, but there is a new branch that may be interesting to you. We do not do it yet. If you want to take care of it, I'm going to assign you with the refractive surgery. And I said, why not? And that is where I started doing refractive surgery, and I always kept on doing refractive procedures. I mean, even cataract surgery, I like to call it a refractive procedure, because the real procedure that we do is replacing the eye, the lens with an artificial one. So I like to call that procedure as lens replacement for cataract purposes, not really cataract surgery. But then you can have other reasons for replacing the lens, like refractive purposes or dysfunctional purposes and all of that. But I really like to stay on the refractive side of the matter, not saying that technically cataract surgery does not involve also skills as regards, technical skills for better removing, for risking less and all of that. But I see the refractive ending of the of the story. The procedure has to bring a refractive advantage to the patient.
So you look at it from a different perspective. So you say, well, it's lens replacement surgery, and we may replace the lens because it's a cataract, it's too opaque. We could replace the lens because it's dysfunctional, very presbyopic, or you know, not transmitting light appropriately, or we could replace it for a purely refractive reason. You have a 57-year-old patient who's a +4 hyperope. The best way to treat that is in the lens.
Exactly. Or we may replace a lens because it's malpositioned. And I'm referring, for instance, to the Marfan syndrome cases that we treat. And they can see well, but they need to have the lens replaced because it's not in the proper positioning. So this is exactly what I tell the patients. Whatever is the reason for them to undergo, let's say, lens replacement, that is the procedure. The reason is different. Cataract, refractive, and all of that. The procedure is lens replacement. And so the target is refraction.
I like that way of thinking about it because you're right. I mean, the most commonly performed refractive surgery in the world is lens replacement, which we are calling cataract. Maybe I should change it to lensreplacementcoach.com instead of cataractcoach.com. I better register that URL.
No, now, I really like to tell the patients cataract is your pathology, but I'm not doing cataract surgery. I'm doing lens replacement because actually what I'm doing is to take your lens, which is opaque, out of your eye and replace it. This is the way they explain the patients about the procedure.
That makes sense. Like if you do, let's say, hip replacement surgery, you're not talking about the disease, you're talking about the procedure. The procedure is, of course, lens replacement surgery. Now, you finished your training in 1990.
Correct.
And so that's like the birth of this. That's right when the excimer laser started to gain in popularity, where we decided to stop doing radial keratotomy. So
exactly.
You were there from the very beginning.
Exactly. The first excimer laser that came to the hospital where I was doing my residency arrived at the end of 1987, actually.
Wow.
And we started with PRK. I don't want to make commercial brands, even if these brands do not exist any longer. But sure. You remember the small optical zone size, 4.5 millimeters.
Yes.
That was available at that time, sir, and we were crazy enough to perform corrections maybe up to like 12 diopters of myopia on that ablation zone size, and patients were turning very highly hyperopic for months before regressing and getting close to plano, let's say. So that was really pioneering surgery. And I really remember how the patients would not complain at that time. So they were happy. Whatever we were going to do, they were happy. Totally different story today if the patient does not get plane or plus minus 0.25, the patient is unhappy. So
right,
completely different world.
Expectations are so much higher. Obviously, technology is a lot better. But even the expectations, though, were so... Yeah, you're right. I have how many patients who come to your clinic compare one eye to the other eye. One eye is 2015, the other eye is 2020, and they think the 2020 eye is bad.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
But we have very high expectations there.
Exactly.
Now, in your clinic, you also like to give a great patient experience, not just the procedure, the whole experience. Tell me about that.
But this goes within the ophthalpreneur's umbrella. So I really think that patients deserve... whatever is the best technology, the best approach, the best experience. And this may go, considering the best procedure, the best IOL to be implanted, but also the way that we deal with the patients, the way that we treat them, the way that we, interact with them. And so the entire entrepreneurial spirit that we have is to, first of all, give patients a better experience, better results, but also, growing the business in ophthalmology, which may, give advantages for all the stakeholders, where, again, the patients are the most important ones. If the business in ophthalmology is going to grow, the companies are going to be happier. The company is going to invest more in research. The ophthalmologists will be happier because they get more revenues from their job. the patients will have benefits because they may take advantages of a better service, a better devices, better procedures, and everybody's going to be happy. It's a win-win situation.
Yeah, if you look at the worldwide incidence of refractive error, only a tiny, tiny percent is being treated with surgery, which is so effective and permanent. So how can we grow it to a bigger number, a bigger percent?
Well, I like to tell everybody that we ophthalmologists or them as an industry focused in the past pretty much on getting a bigger share of the small market they or we used to have. The perspective that we should look at is totally the opposite. We may maintain the same market share, the same, you know, pizza
percentage.
Yes, or if you put it in like in a pie format, the same slice of the pie or the pizza. But if we have a much larger pie, everybody's going to take benefit. That's the key that nice. I'm trying to promote. So not really competing, but align with all the stakeholders, industry, other doctors, other practices, let's say also investors or private equities as well. I mean, we cannot forget now that there are much bigger investors in this field in ophthalmology that we used to play with 10, 15, 20 years ago. And it is worthwhile to have them aligned with the concept that making money is not a target unless we provide better services, unless we provide the better options to the patients. So this is why in the ophthalmopreneurs, we like to involve all these different stakeholders, not just ophthalmologists, not only the industry, but also, as I said, the investors, the administrators, the staff. So every single piece of the business has a role and should play the same.
Yeah, I think you're right. We made a mistake in the past of thinking about our small pie, let me get a larger slice. Mm-hmm. But what makes much more sense is growing the entire market, growing the entire pie. Even if your percentage stays the same, everyone has grown. Because in the worldwide, I think it must be single-digit percent of patients who have refractive errors get treated with surgery, with refractive surgery.
Yeah,
so we're
just
at the beginnings of this.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? The internal competition that patients may see in our websites is just detrimental. Because for as long as we are going to, let's say, advertise, my practice is better than yours, or my technology is better than yours as the competitor, patients will be always confused. Patients will be always question on where is the truth. And you know that fear is the biggest barrier for patients to really embrace or go to refractive surgery. So if we generate in the patients the idea that we as ophthalmologists are not aligned and my procedure is better than yours or my laser is better than yours, well, they will still question about the fact that maybe it's better to wait for some more agreement on what is better for them. So I think that the concept should be the opposite. I mean, there are different procedures, there are different lasers, there are different technologies, there are different IOLs. They're all extremely good. The point is that we need to address each single case, each single patient with the most appropriate one for each single of them.
Right, tailor it to the specific patient. And that's why it's so important for refractive surgery. You have to have the whole spectrum. You can't do only LASIK or only lens. You have to do everything.
Exactly. And you cannot have a single IOL. You cannot have a single presbyopia correcting IOL. You cannot just address spectacle independence after lens replacement for cataract purposes just using one device. Because that device can be perfect for your 70% of patients, but there will be 30% that would not like to have what is the compromise associated to that specific IOL. And you may want to have a backup or a couple of backup IOLs, still providing spectacle independence, maybe with, you know, I'm just comparing, for instance, full range of focus versus increased range of focus. Let's say trifocals versus EDOFs, right? And for some patients, like a trifocals can be the best solution just because they want to have a spectacle independence on a full range of vision. But we know that these lenses are more likely to induce night dysphotopsia. And so there may be patients who would really prefer to have less depth of focus, but a lower rate of dysphotopsia. And even in between the categories, let's say trifocals, there are different options. It's not all the trifocals are doing the same. So I am a fan of providing the patients with different options, not only in terms of IUL categories, but also within the same category. I think there are differences that justify, you know, customizing what the patients like to have.
Right, to have more tools in your toolbox.
Exactly. So
again, I think you're right. It's better to have more options so you can choose a more specific outcome or technology for that patient. Now, you've also had presby LASIK done. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I had presby LASIK. Now it's 5 years ago. I was struggling with my reading glasses. And I did the very common mistake of the ophthalmologist who thinks he is the best in the world and does not need any kind of diagnosing. And that was me or myself. So when I had my presby LASIK, I assumed that I was plano, and I did my presby LASIK, and I saw not only the results fading away, but also I realized that the dominant eye that I did not treat, that I did not have treated, was losing distance vision. So there is where I realized that I was slightly hyperopic as well. Right. And with my loss of accommodation, I was fading. I was losing the effect of presby LASIK because my latent hyperopia was showing up. So I ended up having an enhancement in the laser, in the eye where I had presby LASIK, and a LASIK procedure on the other eye to fix the almost 1 diopter of hyperopia that I was suffering from. I did not even refract myself. I did not even cycloplegic refraction, obviously. I was just giving for sure that, oh, I know who I am. I know where I am in terms of vision, and I'm just plano. So just have one eye treated with the presby LASIK, and I'm going to be happy. Well, the end of the story is that now I'm stable. It's 3.5 years after my enhancement. I can read the 20/15 in my dominant eye. I can read the distance 20/25-ish with my non-dominant eye. Refraction in the non-dominant eye is -1.25. Okay. And as I said, this with presby LASIK allows me to still read easily 20/25 under good light conditions, but I can read 40 centimeters. So I think it's an excellent procedure for patients in between 50 or 45, let's say, to 55, 60 years old. As I like to say also what George Waring used to say, refractive surgery is a journey. I know that my journey is not over. At some point, I will have to undergo LASIK replacement, but presby LASIK provides a very nice bridging period in between 45 to whatever the age cataract surgery has to be done.
Wow, that's, I like that. The refractive surgery is a journey. That's George Waring III, who passed away maybe 5-ish years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
He was a brilliant surgeon. But I think you're right. If you start off a young person, let's say, who becomes myopic in school from all the studying, somewhere maybe about age 20 or early 20s have LASIK to correct the distance vision, then they have great accommodation because they're young. When that patient is about 45, 50 years old, maybe a little presby LASIK, or maybe 60 plus, do some lens replacement.
Exactly.
And there's your journey.
Exactly. And that's exactly the way that I think that we should communicate to the patients, as well as when you're going to have your refractive surgery on yourself, this is what your attitude should be. I'm taking what is best for me now. In future, there are options. Right.
It's like I'm in, like, my surgery center is in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. So the Beverly Hills patients, what's huge here is plastic surgery.
Yep.
And plastic surgeons don't try to do one treatment for the rest of your life. they say this will hold you over for 10 years or whatever years, and then you come back and we do other. So it's also plastic surgery is also like a journey.
Exactly, exactly. It's a very, very similar. I completely agree with you.
So should we have a separate subspecialty? Like it used to be, plastic surgery was just a subspecialty of general surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's broken off into its own subspecialty where they do a little bit, maybe 2-3 years of general surgery, but then it's primarily plastic surgery training. Should in ophthalmology, refractive surgery break out into its own subspecialty independent?
That's the dream for refractive surgeons. And you know, there is an organization called the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences.
I'm a fellow like you.
Right. So as an organization, we are trying to drive this avenue and trying to move not only the ophthalmologists, but also the public opinion on the fact that in the same way that patients asking for aesthetic surgery, let's say, would never go either to the general surgeon or to the cardiac surgeon, but just to the refractive surgeon, that should be the same for patients seeking for spectacle independence. They should go to a refractive surgeon. And you know, many of the refractive surgery procedures done worldwide are done by what I like to call the dabblers, right? Or the Friday afternoon surgeons, meaning that...
They just dabble in it. They do a little bit here and there.
Exactly, exactly. This is good for them, but this is not really good for the patients and for the public opinion, because refractive surgery requires a lot of skills, and most of the skills are not technical. These are not skills that you are having in your hands. These are skills that you have in your brain, in your mind, in your planning way, in your, you know, whatever is not really surgery. And these skills are not taught basically in residence or fellowship programs in most of the world, right? So yeah. What I think it would be very beneficial for the entire refractive surgery movement is homogenizing the curriculum, homogenizing the programs for teaching refractive surgery, having the entire world aligned as regards what is refractive surgery, what are the different technologies, how do we perform it, but also how do we establish that mindset that brings the hands working with the brain, with the planning that it is typical for refractive surgery.
Yeah, you bring a good point that there's very little teaching of refractive surgery in residency and most fellowships. So people like you and me, we're self-taught.
Yeah.
There's no other way. So I think to have a curriculum that's very structured would be very helpful, especially for the young surgeons. Cataract coach listeners in general tend to be younger ophthalmologists. I have the whole spectrum, but there are a lot of young ones. But I think you're right. It'd be nice to have that curriculum. And I think the World College of Refractive Surgery is really working hard to achieve that.
Exactly. And unfortunately, outside of the United States, most of the university departments do not really perform refractive surgery. Just because refractive surgery is not reimbursed by the public health systems. And you know, I'm giving Europe as an example, the entire ophthalmology business goes or lives thanks to the national health systems. So typically the big institutions, the big didactic institutions in Europe do not teach refractive surgery because they do not provide refractive surgery. And this means that refractive surgeons nowadays in Europe has to self-learn what to do, and they basically do not know where and how to, you know, take or apprehend this kind of education. That's the biggest problem. So I think that a global program, a global curriculum, able to, you know, homogenize the way that refractive surgery is taught can be very beneficial for these ophthalmologists who are eager to learn it, but they do not have many chances.
I think you're right. I think I'm excited to see where this goes. And for the young ophthalmologists, we're at the very beginning. Don't think that you missed the train on refractive surgery. It's huge, and we are still such a tiny percentage of it. I mean, if you think of glasses or spectacles, and let's just change fields. Let's say orthopedics. If you say, okay, patients with, you know, bad joint disease, they can use crutches to help them walk. Or you could have a surgery and fix the problem. They don't choose the surgery. But here, when it comes to refractive errors, we say, well, refractive errors, you can just wear glasses, these plastic or metal things on your face forever. Or you can just fix the issue.
Exactly. And to stay in your main, not field of expertise, because you are expert in almost everything related to ophthalmology, but on the Cataract Coach podcast, consider lens replacement surgery or cataract surgery, whatever you want to call it. That is a procedure where we have to do something. It's not right. A choice by the patients undergoing cataract surgery when they have cataract, right?
Correct. And,
visual rehabilitation is not just taking this opaque lens out of the eye and replacing it. Rehabilitation means giving these patients the best possible options according to their needs, their expectations, their lifestyles, and all of that. So I think that the 2020 or 2030 cataract surgeon, let's say purely cataract, should have skills to really address patients with presbyopia correcting IOS as well as toric IOS on a routine fashion, as to really give the patients what is even mandatory to do. I mean, it's like if you need glasses, you want to have everything corrected, right? If you're going to replace an eye lens, you want to have everything corrected. Why not?
Of course.
That's the philosophy.
It's sometimes difficult to convince, even in my clinic for patients, you'll have a patient come in and say, I just want a plain cataract surgery, nothing refractive, don't address my astigmatism. And I'll say to the patient, this makes zero sense. If I'm already going inside the eye to remove the lens, the cataract, let me fix the spherical error. Let me fix the astigmatism. If needed, let me address the presbyopia, all at the same setting.
Exactly. Exactly. And I acknowledge that correcting presbyopia still involves some sort of compromises. Because it's a short blanket, right? So if you privilege the spectacle independence, you're going to compromise a little bit on quality of vision in dysphotopsia, and vice versa. But there is no reason for not trying to address the other issues. I mean, astigmatism correction, I think, is a must. I do not consider astigmatism management during, you know, lens replacement surgery as an option. That is mandatory, because there is no reason for leaving astigmatism behind. I mean, there is not a single reason for ending up with the patients having more than half of the diopters of astigmatism. No patients would take benefit from that.
Right. No, that could be a challenge. Although I have one example of a patient who came in to see me for lens replacement surgery, cataract surgery. Entire life has been plano minus two diopters at 180.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the challenge here is the patient always walks around without glasses because the patient has two focal points. In one meridian, plano, and the other meridian, minus two. And the patient's used to walking around with uncorrected astigmatism. So how do I address that patient? What do I do?
Right. This is a very good point. When these patients are refractive patients, meaning that their vision is not significantly compromised, I really believe that is kind of mandatory to test with the contact lenses how their vision would be after surgery. This is something that we do on a routine basis. We are lucky because we have a little department of contact lens fitting in my practice, and so we can address it the same day they come for consultation. But you're right, sometimes these patients may not be happy when correcting something that has never been corrected for all right. Lines. Yeah.
And yeah, that's the only a little challenge.
Yeah. But you're making a very good point. Sometimes you have to think out of the box and not just routinely do what you think is better. Sometimes you have to think out of the box and maybe question yourself on what rationally you would do, but practically may not lead to a benefit to the patient. And there is where I think that refractive surgeons' mindset should be. So as I was telling you earlier, it's not in our hands only. It's in our way of seeing each single patient for their individual way.
Right. You can't do one size fits all. It doesn't work.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, speaking of thinking outside the box and thinking differently, tell me about your meeting ophthalmopreneurs. We'll put a link down below for his meeting. I heard so many great things about this meeting. I felt so bad that I missed it this year, but I definitely need to come next year.
Well, Ophthalmopreneurs, as I was telling you, was born by an idea from myself, and I have to acknowledge my wife, Amanda Cardwell, who has a background in ophthalmology as wide as I am, but on a different perspective. She used to work in the United States for many years, for a major company, and for that major company, she was doing practice performance and practice development. So she has a lot of skills as regards how to address patients with the best options and best solutions on an individual fashion. So the entire concept was born, let's say, a couple of years ago, when we submitted a course to one of the major meetings in Europe, and the course was rejected. And we said, listen, I think there is an unmet need in the topics that we want to deal with. Let's do it by ourselves. So we started, you know, considering making a meeting that originally was, or more than a meeting, let's say a course that was supposed to be for 30, 40 people, maybe half a day or one day. In the first edition of Ophthalpreneurs, actually involved 250 people, and the meeting was 2.5 days long, because we found way more acceptance, way more,
interest in your course.
Interested, exactly, in that than we expected. And we discovered ongoing, that especially in Europe and in Latin countries like South America, as well as part of Asia, the unmet need of patients' education, as well as staff training, as well as practice performance and development are really issues. And so, from a local small meeting, now we had this first edition with participants coming from Argentina, Brazil, Australia, Asia, obviously Europe, United States, we were encouraged to keep on and working on that, and so we are going to have the next edition next year in Taormina, Sicily, wonderful little town, like a medieval town, which I really suggest you today to come and visit, not only for the meeting, but just for having a nice holiday there. And we are planning to have not really a larger meeting, because the meeting has a purpose, and the purpose is networking, communication, and not really presenting, but interacting. And you know that if a meeting involves more than 200-250 individuals, there's no way for really interacting. So we want to keep the meeting small, but we want to open different scenarios. So this year we will have a meeting run during the main meeting, but just for the staff and for the administrators, as to be able to address their own individual needs. Let's see what happens. I mean, this is something that I really feel like part of my mission. Mission is also your vision. My vision is that refractive surgery should be, at a higher level than it is now. I think that bar should be raised. And when I say refractive surgery, obviously, I'm not just referring to laser procedure. I'm referring to whatever is going to change the vision of our patients.
Sure.
And there is where I think that my second half of my job is going to be dedicated for. I like to do my surgery. I like to deal with my patients, but I really like to feel like I'm giving some more to the next generation as regards how to, you know, improve their skills and not necessarily surgical skills, as I said, how to help them developing their business and at the end of the day, how to give their patients a better service in future.
So focusing more on the experience, but also the surgery and the outcomes.
Exactly.
But sometimes as surgeons, we just focus on surgery and maybe a little on the outcomes, but we forget about the whole patient experience. So what's the patient experience like in your clinic?
Well, and again, I have to acknowledge my wife. Patient experience in my clinic is the tagline. I mean, my practice is called Advalia, but we have a tagline which is trademarked in Europe. And the trademarked tagline is the patient experience. For us, a patient should have the best possible results in terms of surgery, but the patient should live the entire experience since the first phone call or the first, web approach to the last post-operative visit as a very nice experience. The experience involves whatever is related to the ophthalmology, deal, but also whatever is going to be beneficial to the patients in terms of service, in terms of, making them feeling like the environment, the staff, the technicians, the surgeons are at their side as regards education, as regards explanations, as regards everything. So we really focus on a comprehensive experience involving all the aspects of their journey through the, not only the practice, but through the entire experience, as I said. If you focus this on, let's say, any sort of refractive procedure, this means being able to offer them a great education, a great explanation process. This involves also giving them as many options as possible and focusing back on the different technologies that are available today. But this also gives them a reason for celebrating. What we do on a routine basis now is offering them a bottle of champagne after the surgery. And to take it home and say, listen, it's like you bought your new car. And when you bought your new car, you're celebrating. Now you bought your new vision. You own your vision back, and you have to celebrate with your family tonight. So we offer them always a bottle of champagne to celebrate at the same
time. I like that.
Yeah. That's the philosophy.
That's a brilliant idea to make it. Yeah, this is a big change for a patient. It's a big improvement in their life. It's something to be celebrated. And also another good benefit is when they're serving the champagne, why are you serving champagne tonight? I'm celebrating my new vision. Oh, exactly. Tell me about it. Here's the experience I had. And then, that's very great word of mouth.
Yeah.
Good marketing.
I can tell you, marketing-wise, it's not reason, but it is a marketing tool. I mean, we have patients who are coming and saying, when is my bottle going to come? Because someone else told them that we are going to get it.
Oh, that's fantastic. No, it sounds like it's a great experience because I've also figured that, learning my practice, the barrier to refractive surgery is not cost. It's patient fear and patients who don't understand.
Exactly.
If we can work together to educate the patients, help them understand, and help alleviate their fears, then they're open to the refractive surgery. And price is really not the sticking point.
Exactly. I completely agree with you. And the other big point that I always like to focus on is that for whatever we can investigate in terms of surveys, in terms of questionnaires and all of that, unfortunately, all of this are always going to the ones that we already intersected. You see what I mean, right? The patients who already came to the practice, or the patients who already are in the softwares we use to track them and all of that. But the huge population that we do not intersect with are those who are not coming, are those who are still too much worried or reluctant or worried about showing up. You see the point?
And so yes,
that group of patients is the huge reservoir, the huge container where we may bring benefits and they take benefits from, right? And so there is where patients or previously treated patients may really do a better job than what we do. So if we have happy patients and we have patients who are commenting on not only the results of the surgery, but also on the experience, we may have patients were not approaching us and just coming, not really for taking out of glasses, but just to live the experience. You see the point? And then when the experience is nice, they may consider going on and eventually get rid of the glasses once they are, aligned on the fact that they are good candidates and all of that.
So how do we get the message out to the 90% of patients who have refractive errors and who don't have any knowledge of surgery? How do we teach the whole public?
That's the big quest. That's the big question that I don't think that has been addressed yet. I think that as a global scale, it is still difficult to do. I think that in future, only a global campaign of awareness may be beneficial. Well, the campaign should not be targeted or addressed on a specific procedure, on a specific device, on a specific laser. The campaign should be refractive surgery safe. Refractive surgery means a lot of different procedures and no one is better than the others. Your doctor is going to tell you what is most appropriate for you. The campaign should involve all the stakeholders. The campaign should start from the companies in terms of funding, for instance, but also in terms of communication. The companies, the big players, should communicate this branch of ophthalmology is safe. Your experts, your refractive surgeons know who tell no or yes to. Trust them. You see the point that I'm making?
Absolutely. And that's a big challenge because you're right. A lot of times some of the company players will say, no, we just want to grow our market share as opposed to growing the whole pie.
Exactly.
But if you look like in the USA, the volume of keratorefractive surgery over the last many, at least 10 plus years, has not increased.
Right. And you know what? We like to make this comparison as regards refractive surgery with the aviation industry. If you go back 50, 60, 70 years, aviation industry was a disaster because plane crashes were very frequent and people were very scared about flying. So what happened 50, 60, 70 years ago? It happened that the aviation agencies started working together to assess a safety first. And once this safety criteria were assessed, stabilized, and communicated, well, the world changed. So everybody now fly, and we still see plane crashes, but the perception from the patients is that flying is extremely safe. So this is why I'm saying the global community, the global community of stakeholders, ophthalmologists, industry, investors, everybody should work together to set that safety profile and safety concept to the patients as to communicate that in the same way that aircrafts are safe and the aviation business is safe, same is for refractive surgery. So do not be scared about flying. Do not be scared or worried about having refractive surgery done.
That's really a great point because, everyone hears this message. the companies tell you, the aviation companies will tell you, like, no, it's, you're more likely to die in a car accident on the drive to the airport than you are to die on the plane. So it's very, very safe. And you're right. They set the standards that are not only nationwide, but worldwide standards for aviation. And because of that, they raise the safety level quite a bit. Still, nothing's perfect. There's still, on occasion, a plane crash. But the public perception is that it's safe, it's great, and I want to travel, and I want to see the world. And so everyone flies now.
Exactly. And people are complaining about you know, the aviation agencies, not because of safety, but just because of costs and delays. But that's another story.
No, but that'd be really neat. Because, yeah, there's so much potential for refractive surgery, and we're just such at the beginning of this.
Exactly. So, exactly. But you see there, when I say that, it's more a matter of a global communication, not individual communication. We can do our best in our local communities, but we cannot give the global message to everybody that what we are doing is safe.
Yeah, and we have to convince other ophthalmologists. Listen, we're not competing with each other.
Exactly. Exactly. Or there is competition, but this is not the point. The point is that, and I go back to the same comparison, the aviation business is competing.
Sure.
But no one is saying my aircraft is safer than yours.
Right.
Or is faster than yours.
Right.
You see the point?
Right. Yeah, of course, because now we see ophthalmologists will say, my laser is safer, my surgery is faster than yours. Mine.
Exactly. If you look at what the aviation agencies or business are advertising, is on services. It's not on safety, because safety has been
established.
It's already given for granted. It's not on volume. I mean, the biggest airline is not advertising as, oh, I am the one caring more patients. Because no one would care.
Yeah.
Why in our websites are still writing, I am the surgeon with most of the experience in the world? It doesn't matter. What we are communicating to the patients with this kind of approaches is that if I'm the biggest implanter of the IOS or the biggest laser surgeon, it means that I have more experiences. So if you come to my practice, it's going to be safer. That's a mistake. Again, we should not communicate in that way.
Yeah, so that's maybe where your meeting fits in. We can work together. Now, tell me about the meeting a little bit more. You said it's not presentations or lectures, but rather it's interaction.
Exactly. The meeting is set in a way that, or at least I'm giving you the example of the first and last meeting we had.
Sure.
The meeting was based on four main chapters or pillars. And these chapters were going from I want to build a practice, first pillar. I want to make it efficient, second pillar. I want to monitor the efficiency of my practice, third pillar. And I want to get rid of my practice because I'm at the end of the career, and I want to take advantage of what I built in my career. So the establishment of a practice, the entire lifespan of a potential practice. So we have these four chapters where during the first chapter, the first pillar, the first morning, let's say, all the topics were, you know, focusing on where, how, why building a practice or establishing the clinic. And the discussion was more on the logistics, on the strategies, on the location, on the niche of patients that you may want to intersect, and all of that. And the second half day was on the, now that I have a practice, how can I make it efficient? So what strategies to improve patient outreach, the use of electronic medical records, or the use of you know, the, how do you call them in English, the, like a Salesforce, to give you a name, what's the name of the it's a software to track the patients, you see.
Oh, yeah, patient tracking, sure.
Yeah, all of that. The third topic the next morning was more on the, well, now that you have your practices in, it is working efficiently, how am I going to boost the efficiency in terms of, expanding, opening new offices and all of that. In the last day, the last half day, we discussed on what approach should we have with, private equities or investment groups or and all of that when at some point you want to, sell your practice.
You want to exit, yeah.
Exactly, you have your exit strategy. And the meeting was a hold in a way of, introductory presentations. Many of these introductory presentations were not given by ophthalmologists or people in this field. We had university professors who are psychology, bringing their point of view on how to interact with the patients. Or we have a very well-quoted university in Milan called the Bocconi, which is like a business management university, same reputation as the Harvard University or the Kellogg Northwestern. And we had university professors explaining how to build your own business plan.
Wow.
Or how to measure your EBITDA, because we as ophthalmologists we don't have the skills for doing that.
We're never taught it. Exactly. In your medical fellowship, no one ever teaches you this.
Exactly. So the presentation given by someone not really in the field of ophthalmology, but knowing how to deal with patients, how to deal with business and all that, was a trigger to have then conversations, interactions, exercises, workshops and all of that. So we really enjoyed it as a meeting, because it was a very networking meeting with a lot of interaction, with a lot of case scenarios presented and discussion. And that's the topic. That this is the way that we like to have this meeting done. So everybody is a presenter, actually. There may be someone on the podium to, throw the stone into the pond and see the waves, but then you are the one who are managing the waves and try to get the best from the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to learn. I don't want to sit in the lecture hall and just listen to a lecture for an hour. I want to be involved in it.
Exactly.
And I think that's what you do very, very well for that meeting. That's why I'm really looking forward to going to it next year.
In Taormina,
I've already put it on my calendar.
I'm going to send you an invitation then. In Taormina, we will have in France, they say the fil rouge, which means the common topic going through the 2.5 days is going to be communication. And communication means communication with your patients, but communication may be also related to the industry. Communication may be related also to what you're presenting from the podium, any sort of communication. And one of the ideas that we are trying to develop is having a lecturer from a sommelier, because Sicily is very, they have great wines. We want to have a sommelier on the podium, and we want to have three, four glasses of wine on every single table, as to learn how to communicate the taste and the flavors and the sense of wine in a wine tasting fashion.
Oh, it's so innovative.
Yeah, because we want to learn how to communicate about perception. And when we communicate, when we ask the patients, how is your vision? They say, good. We want to learn what good means. Same way as wine is. When you drink your wine, you say, how is that? It's good. But a sommelier would tell you, this has a nut taste with a background flavor of whatever you want to be. So giving a much more complex way for communicating what that specific wine is. I think that we should learn from some other, industry, like the winemaking industry, how to communicate what we perceive, what patients feel about their vision, and maybe learning how to communicate this in a different way.
Well, for sure. That's a great example where it's wine is something purely elective.
Yep.
And it's something that it gives it's a patient or a personal experience in it. And exactly. Then they have to communicate this. You're right. When I read a description of a wine, it says, oh, hints of stone fruit and soft tannins. And when I read it, it makes sense to me. But I would just say, if you ask me, how's the wine? I'd just say, it's good. I like it.
I like it.
Right. But I'm not so good at communicating those specific little details. So, yeah, that's a great idea. I'm looking forward to learning from that.
And we'll have fun also.
Well, of course. Yeah, to be able to communicate with patients in a way that's a little bit more refined and gets your message across better, I think would be important. Yeah, for us in a clinic, communication with the patients, communication with our staff, and then even communications afterwards.
Exactly.
Which you do so well with the champagne bottle. I meant to ask you, why champagne instead of Prosecco?
Actually, we are giving, I'm referring to champagne. We are not giving Prosecco, we are giving an Italian wine that is not Prosecco, but it is made in the same way that champagne is made.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
Call it Spumante. It's the Trentino Spumante, exactly.
That makes more sense. I said, wait, why is he giving away French wine? No, Italian.
We are not giving French, you're right. We are giving Italian, but champagne for communicating is easier than saying Trentino Spumante, Doc. It is more complex.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to the meeting. Again, I'll put a link down below if people are interested. It is going to be a limited meeting. You're not going to have 1,000 surgeons there. It's going to be on a smaller side.
It's going to be 2,020 people. That's the limit that we want to keep the meeting.
250, at. You said. 250.
250. Yeah. Sorry, 250 attendants.
I will reserve my spot early.
We reserved an entire hotel. So the entire hotel is at our disposal. I mean, all the facilities. The hotel is great. It's a resort on the sea. I mean, you do not even have to cross a road to get to the sea. It's in a location that it is fantastic. Taormina is an ancient city, as I said, and it deserves, just the city deserves a touristic trip there. And we want to keep the spirit of, a community as we had during the meeting we had this year. So we want to have all dinners together, all lunches together, all breakfasts together, as to build a community that is going to speak for 2.5 days on how to make the things better.
Fantastic. And that's going to be April 2025. April next year.
April 10 to 13.
Of next year.
Yeah. So
put it on your calendar, everyone. Francesco, I want to thank you for doing our podcast. What a great time talking to you. I learned so much. I definitely look forward to interacting with you a lot more at your meetings. I'll see you at the ESCRS coming up in Barcelona. And again, I want to remind our viewers and listeners, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday. And of course, we still got a new Cataract Coach video every single day. So until next time, we'll catch you later.